You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, one of the least plausible contenders for the presidency of the United States also appears to be one of the most determined. My guests Roger Boyes and Michael Goldfarb will both play Sancho Panza to Lawrence Lessig's Don Quixote and ask what the Harvard professor hopes to gain by challenging Hillary Clinton. We'll also be looking at the day's other big stories, including after China provokes the United States by building artificial islands in the South China Sea, the US goads China by sailing a warship in the general vicinity. We'll ask if it's clear to either side where they're going with this. We'll also try to look past the fact that regional elections in Ukraine in general and Odessa in particular have more resembled a Star Wars convention than a political process towards the bigger picture, the progress of imported governor Mikhail Saakashvili. And after one French socialist MP suggests that the National Front's Marine Le Pen is a certainty to win his country's next presidential election, we'll assess the chances that he's right. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Roger Boyes, diplomatic editor at The Times, and the author and journalist Michael Goldfarb. Welcome both back to the program. We will start tonight with the US presidential campaign, specifically the race for the Democratic Party's nomination. If the bookmakers are right, it's pretty much all over already, especially following last week's withdrawals from the contest by Lincoln Chafee and Jim Webb. The odds on Hillary Clinton are now only slightly longer than you'd get on the sun rising tomorrow. Among those undaunted, however, is the Harvard boffin, Lawrence Lessig, who continues to campaign despite no prospect of winning and barely any more hope of getting anyone to notice that he's actually running. Michael, first of all, what is the value, if indeed there is any, of a kamikaze presidential run of this sort?
Well, the value clearly is that at least it gets subjects debated, which in the extraordinarily narrow range of topics that now qualify as news and newspapers, you can actually discuss his issue. And his issue, of course, is campaign financing. Ever since the Supreme Court, very conservative Supreme Court now, ruled that corporations are human beings in some way and free and entitled to the free speech. They give as much money as you like. Money, of course, rules campaigns. And in fact, it's not even about campaigns. I mean, it's a whole area of service industry with billions of dollars sloshing around Washington and other parts of America during election cycles. And a lot of people get employed doing it. Anyway, Lawrence Lessig, who's a professor, specializes in cyber law, actually, at Harvard Law School, wants to completely reform campaign finance. And he wants to be in the debates so that this can be a question that's discussed in the debates that are left. You know, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have mostly been discussing economic issues. That's what Bernie Sanders' insurgent candidacy has meant. That's why he's doing it, I hope. Because if he actually thinks that he's going to have any chance at all of even making it on the ticket as vice president, he's displaying the pathology of the tenured mind, which is, especially at Harvard, where you know, not speaking out of school here, but you're allowed to make the equivalent of your salary in outside money. And this is important to tenured professors at the law school. So he makes a very good living. And, you know, he thinks, what more have I got to do? I'm well struck in years. I might as well give running for president, because in America, anybody can become president, right?
And as somebody once said, that's just the risk you take. Roger, he is initially, at least, a single-issue candidate. He was going to run on campaign finance reform, which is a worthy issue. In fact, you would struggle, I think, to find a sane American who thinks the system is working in absolutely tip-top condition. But when you do this, though, we should note that he has now broadened his platform into other areas and says he's a serious candidate and will serve a full term if elected. where is the line between becoming an advocate for your cause and giving it that national prominence and then possibly doing that cause a disservice if you end up getting caricatured as a fringe crank who is, flying a kite, really?
Well, I mean, just by running and failing, he makes a point about campaign financing, says he doesn't seem to have any money at all to back his campaign and will no doubt flop for that reason. I don't know, frankly. It seems to me he's not quite in the Ross Perot kind of territory, but he is does seem to have some kind of psychological problems. It's not so much about the issue as some kind of exhibitionism of an academic who thinks his time has somehow come on this issue, and will therefore discredit it because he will fall apart. As it looks from Harvard, I would imagine you could say that the whole Democratic field is falling apart. I mean, Hillary, you may think Hillary's a shoo-in, but those emails are pretty toxic. He may have thought, I mean, maybe sitting around the common room or whatever you have in Harvard, they may have said, well, you know, give it a go, there's nobody else wants to do it, you know, and he runs, you know.
I have spent some time in Cambridge, and it is true that trial balloons tend to have a higher helium quotient in Cambridge than they do in other places. But it seems to be, I mean, Elizabeth Warren used to be a law school professor at Harvard, and she did the right thing, which is she ran for Senate. Mm-hmm. But there's a fair number of people who make attempts. I think there's a security specialist at the Kennedy School of Government named Juliet Kayyem, who made a run for some state government position. Actually, might have even been senator last year. She was soundly defeated. There's a terrible thing that happens over dinner tables in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where, you know, there's a high quotient. People listening should understand that. I mean, there's this conveyor belt, revolving door, not conveyor belt, between Harvard and administrations. And you can be at Harvard and be a Republican. And if there's a Republican in the White House, suddenly you're in Washington as a special advisor. Republicans lose the White House, you're go through the revolving door and you get your position back at Harvard. And it's the same with the Democrats. Mm. So there is this sense, I mean, probably more than any other academic institution in America, except maybe Stanford with the Hoover Institute, that you say, well, I talked to the president when he was my law student, therefore I have a place at the table in Washington. Why not me?
Mm. Well, I mean, Andrew's question was, is it a rational act? And the answer is no, because if you've got money to burn for a cause, then you either set up a foundation and burn it that way, or you buy advertisements in the New York Times. You can get half a page in the New York Times for $50,000, $60,000. Well, you know, that's a week's worth of coverage for your idea. Why on earth enter a political process in which you will be branded as a failure and therefore your idea too?
It's probably worth noting before we move on that the bookmakers are currently offering 200-1 on Professor Lessig becoming the Democratic nominee, which of course were exactly the odds you could have got on Jeremy Corbyn becoming leader of the Labour Party at one point.
Another great brain.
We will now visit Beijing, where the ambassador from the United States has been summoned to the foreign ministry to receive a wigging from China's vice foreign minister. The reason for China's umbrage is an alleged incursion into Chinese territorial waters by an American destroyer, the USS Lassen. The matter is complicated by the fact that the territory in question is artificial, part of a program of Chinese island building in the South China Sea. Roger, first of all, you pass diplomatic speak for a living. China has called the move provocative and irresponsible. What does that actually mean?
Well, it means butt out, but I mean, it's not, first of all, I'd like to praise China for bringing this whole concept of creating artificial islands as a way of projecting power. I think if more people did this, then we'd be in a very interesting situation. But no, it's, I think that, that China is an insurgent power rising, that America is perceived by a bloc, of which Russia is a member, to be a power in decline. Where do we test this relative strength? We test it on our own territory, seen from Beijing. A territory, by the way, which you've created with a few bulldozers in the middle of the South China Sea, dredgers probably, and see what happens next. But I think the whole point is a signal to the rest of Southeast Asia, really. You know, there's the security agreement between Japan and America runs out in 2032. And it's trying to show that the future belongs to Chinese dominion on this coast, and not on America. And that's what it's doing. And it's probably being registered everywhere. It's being registered in Vietnam. It's being registered in the Philippines. It's being registered, especially in Japan. And we will see what happens next.
Michael, how confected do you think the Chinese outrage is here? Because they know when they do something like build an island in the South China Sea that America's going to respond. They have a fair idea of what the American response is going to be. They won't send an aircraft carrier because that's too big a deal, and they won't send some small frigate because that's too small a deal. They'll send a guided missile destroyer, which is exactly what they've done. So is this all a bit theatrical?
Michael gets his teeth into this, can I just say these islands are supposed to be kind of aircraft carriers? That's kind of the
indeed
point.
So.
And that's why China's worried. Sorry. That's why America's worried.
Well, until there's something else, I still see it as shadow play, both sides. And I think that it's a kind of skirmishing. And, you know, President Xi has been both in Washington and here in Britain as well over the last month. And you wonder if any of this at some point, and if not directly between the two presidents in Washington, then at least their senior staff, if this has come up at all about what we think about these islands and what our response will be. So I see this more as shadow play and, you know, not being a China expert, but being someone who like everybody else, who's sentient, reads a lot about day-to-day stuff. It isn't, if this happened in another part of the world, you would say this is a government which is overseeing an economy that is having a certain amount of problem. And so whenever that happens, you rattle the saber at the foreign enemy. Maybe there's an element of that.
Roger, is conducting this shadow play, as Michael calls it, in the military realm somewhat redundant? Because isn't the reality that when push comes to shove in that part of the world, China is going to do as it pleases, and there's not really an awful lot anyone can do to stop them?
Yes, that's probably true, and will become truer over the next 10, 15 years, because Chinese Navy is on a expansionist curve at the moment. But I think these are basically mind games, and the military operates according to its own fear and war scenarios. And one of them is that one of the Chinese fears is that Americans will be able, because of their advanced technology, America's so way ahead of China on all military technology, that it's been a little bit complacent about all this. But China is worried exactly because of this technological advantage that they will be able to bombard the Chinese coast. Yeah? So it now has to set up some kind of system of deterrence and say, well, you know, it has to somehow neutralize America's technological advantage. So we've got essentially the beginnings of an arms race, not exactly pre-1914 arms race, but still a proper arms race, especially with Japan slowly arming up a bit. And that's what's happening. And you know, arms races can be stable. You know, they don't have to be destabilizing, but they have to be managed. And that is perhaps one of the challenges that China is now giving to America, which is talk to us about this, and let's work out rules of conduct on our sea, yeah, on our sea.
Michael, how confident are you, or how confident should we be, that those rules are understood? Because the thing is, as I'm sure both Beijing and Washington are well aware, having done this once, sort of sent one warship in the general vicinity of China's artificial islands, America's now kind of obliged to pull a similar stunt every so often, isn't it, in order to maintain its position and maintain what it might think of as credibility in dealing with China?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think it's just, as Roger was saying, I mean, there's a certain amount of sparring, but I don't think it's serious at all. Do you remember Kimoi and Matsu?
No.
You see,
maybe you're older than me.
in the 1960 presidential debate between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy, they were debating, it was live, and suddenly Kennedy said, "We have to be very worried about Kimoi and Matsu." What is Kimoi and Matsu? They were two islands, but natural islands, near Taiwan that China was claiming. Yeah. Would we go to war over Kimoi and Matsu? Mm. We never went to war over Kimoi and Matsu, but because Kennedy knew about them and Nixon didn't, he was perceived to have a stronger grasp of foreign policy, and it did help him, along with his father purchasing some votes, win the presidency.
Did anyone look it up and find out whether Kimoi and Matsu actually exist?
Oh, no, they did exist. They were rocks. I mean, they were, you know, they were, you know, bat guano stations.
Yeah. I mean, the Spratlys, you know, are not worth fighting over. You know, they're just rocks. Yeah.
But, for sure. But, Roger, on that front, though, this pass by the USS Larsen, to what extent, aside from being America reminding that China that they're there, to what extent is it also a gesture of reassurance to Japan and Taiwan?
Well, exactly. It is about, as I mentioned at the beginning, that this security agreement with Japan is extremely important and runs its course at some stage. And Japan's very nervous about it. That's why it's beginning to militarize more relatively. I mean, America has tried, not just in military terms, but in trade terms, to position itself as the protector, as the natural protector of Southeast Asia. Either you believe in that or you don't. And China understands that its way of establishing dominion is to weaken American credibility. Well, that's what's happening now. The chances of guns being fired are not very strong. But carry on like this for another 5 years, and I wouldn't be so sure.
Well, on that happy thought, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Roger Boyce and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next, we'll find out how the former president of Georgia is doing as governor of Odessa.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
You know, Tokyo is fantastic. It's a very grown-up city. You know, it's not a sort of superficial love for Tokyo. It grows, and that's what's really kept me here for so long. So it's just great to live here. Fantastic. I love it. I never get sick of it.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
And you're welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Roger Boyce and Michael Goldfarb. Now, even by the recent surreal standards of Ukrainian politics, this past weekend's local elections, especially in Odessa, were rather a collector's item. Chewbacca ended up in court on charges of failing to provide ID documents while driving Darth Vader to the polling station. He paid a small fine. And Emperor Palpatine won a seat on the city council. And if I have, by the way, mispronounced Palpatine there, please don't write in, I don't care. Little of which was weirder than the fact that the whole thing occurred on the watch of a governor, Mikhail Saakashvili, for it is he, imported earlier this year from another country entirely. Roger, first of all, the phrase "in May," to me, Governor Saakashvili of Odessa, instantly sounded somewhat mad. A few months later, does it seem any more reasonable?
Well, he's, yeah. I mean, first of all, someone's got to govern this country, and the Ukrainian political class is very thin and very thinly stretched. And Shakashvili was, at the beginning of his tenure in Georgia, after the Rose Revolution, was actually quite an effective anti-corruption campaigner. He got the traffic police, reformed in no time at all. So if you identify the main problem of Odessa as being corruption, building up trust with investors, and, generally modernizing, then maybe Shakashvili is not a bad gun for hire, and he's got plenty of international connections and so on. But the problem is, of course, he hates Putin. Putin hates him. This is maybe not a problem in Ukraine, but will lead to probably some kind of brinkmanship if the Russians ever got antsy in that end of town. But it seemed to me an interesting kind of way of grabbing the headlines. What bothers the Ukrainians most and locally is his appointment of Maria Gaidar, who is Yegor Gaidar's daughter, the Russian reformer. And they don't like the idea of even reformers from Russia coming in and helping to run Odessa. So he's not shown a fantastically firm sense of judgment in running the city. But, it's early days, and why not give it a go unless he, declares independence for Odessa or tries to declare war on Russia?
Well, what I'm interested to know, and maybe Roger knows, is when Shakashvili first came on everyone's radar in Georgia, much was made of the fact of his American connections, both in terms of education, and he had bought into the program, not so much of neoliberalism, but of the kind of he had bought the democratic arguments that were being put forward, throughout the former Eastern Bloc countries, about the importance of markets and transparency and all of that stuff. And he was the poster boy for it. He was an attractive young guy. He was in his late 30s. When the call came to go to Odessa, he's long since not been able to walk down the street in Georgia, from what I can figure. Mm-hmm. He was living in Brooklyn, again, America. And I do wonder if somewhere in the background, a variety of contacts through certain think tanks and connections.
I think Michael's saying it's a CIA plot.
No, not at all. I mean, it doesn't have to be, far from being a CIA plot. I'm just wondering if those networks went into play, and that at a certain point when President Poroshenko was in Washington and meeting with not just the White House, but also in particular with Republicans in Congress, and so said, what you really need, the person you should really call is Micha, because he's up there in New York, he's not really doing anything, and he could really help you sort out the problems in Odessa of corruption. And maybe he said yes, and it all worked out because he is strongly anti-Putin. But, in that country, in Ukraine, there doesn't seem to be any gray area left, except maybe in certain cosmopolitan quarters of Kiev. You're either a Ukrainian or you're a Russian. And it's a country that seems to be very, very much pulled apart. And I don't know how he can last, because he isn't, in the end, Ukrainian.
Well, we're going to move on to territories closer to home now, and finally tonight, and we're persisting with the theme of perhaps unlikely ascent to a nation's highest office. At least one French politician believes that the National Front's Marine Le Pen is a live prospect to become president in 2017. It's a prediction more noteworthy for being made by someone who hopes they're wrong, a socialist MP called Malek Bouty. Indeed, he went so far as to say that he didn't see how Le Pen could possibly lose. Roger, first of all, it's not an attractive prospect for all sorts of reasons. Is it possible that he's right?
Well, of course, Bouty is saying that because he wants to put the boot into Hollande. He's doing it to ginger up socialist politics. But it's possible, I think, because this whole migration wave, which is now actually going to get worse and endure until the 2017 elections in Germany as well as France, that politics is changing in Europe and changing quite a lot. So you're getting a lot of movement on the far right. We've got a new Polish government, which is quite strongly leaning to the right. And Switzerland, something happened. And, there's quite a lot of movement now in reaction either to the fear of migration or to the realities of migration. And frankly, Marine Le Pen could well profit from that. But you have to remember that she's not just far right. I mean, that's to say she's not just Eurosceptic and anti-immigrant, but she also has quite leftist economic policies, protectionist state capitalism and this kind of thing. And this appeals to an awful lot of leftist voters. So, yeah, she could maybe do it. This is the kind of one of these kind of shifts that's going on. Britain, too, of course.
I mean, I think that you should... I find her to be a very formidable person, not just on this recent immigrant wave, which has obviously created a good fair wind for people who are skeptical about immigration, but going back more than a year, I mean, she has very successfully detoxified the Front National over the years. And you know, with the exclamation point of throwing her father out of the party. And she has asserted herself as her own woman. This kind of leftish populist economics, I think, probably has expanded the potential reach of the National Front. And she is a charismatic and formidable campaigner. Now, is it enough? I mean... remind me again, when Jean-Marie Le Pen got into the runoff...
2002.
In 2002. And then he was crushed, right? Because the socialists, once again, were just in an appalling position.
And the fear of him coming in. Consolidated.
So people were literally walking through puddles of disinfectant to vote for Chirac.
Yes, exactly. But this is, my point is that she is far less of a divisive figure at this moment than Jean-Marie Le Pen ever was in his career. And if the Front National could get to the runoff once, it's not a precedent-shattering thing to think that Marine Le Pen could get to the runoff. And then once you're in the runoff, when that comes, and it's still a little ways away, you know, if the economy is still in the doldrums, if there has been no European-wide solution to the immigration wave, which isn't going to stop. It may slow down over winter, but Syria isn't going to be solved next week, and there will be lots more people coming. She may well find that the tide has turned. And, you know, look, Viktor Orban, this new government in Poland, it isn't out of the realms of possibility. So even if Melek Bouti was putting the booty in to François Hollande. François Hollande, he could be deposed by his own party, although he's a very, very canny infighter, which is why he managed to get to the top anyway. I don't see it as an impossibility. Mm. I really don't.
I mean, for the first time in my life, anyway, the far right might soon become to be seen as ahead of their time. And instead of yesterday's men. And this is really a scary, scary idea. But maybe it shouldn't be a scary idea. Maybe it's something we should be thinking about and talking about.
Final thought, though, Roger. Michael was talking there about her detoxifying the National Front. But to what extent for a party like hers, does an element of toxicity kind of play to a base? She was in court last week in Lyon to answer charges of incitement to racial hatred, going back to remarks she made in 2010, comparing France's Muslim population to the Nazi occupation. Does she still need to pander to the nastier reaches of that sentiment in order to keep a right-wing movement on the go?
Well, this is just straightforward reflex. Farage uses the same here. Basically, the establishment is muzzling us. You know, we're anti-establishment. We're the only ones who tell the truth. We tell the truth to power. We're incorruptible, you know, and of course, pretty soon it emerges that all that's wrong. But nevertheless, it's what she plays. Yeah.
And besides, the real nasties can always follow her father to whatever new party he sets up. It's very clever for her to pull away from them.
We will have to leave it there. Michael Goldfarb and Roger Boyce, thank you both very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Antonia Mertoisa. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Daniel Giacopelli will keep you company with music from Monocle's international playlist. Josh Fennett follows him at 1900 with Section D. I'm back with Dom Reynolds for the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.